jazz tune, and I'm always trying to add to my catalog. And the more I sing and the more I play, the more I'm trying to keep pace with tunes I only half know, which is usually how I land on what this show covers. It's something that gets called before I'm ready for it, and then I go home and start digging. But not this time. I knew the head for this one. This time I went looking on purpose for a tune built for horn players instead of singers, something where the story lives more in the changes than on a lyric sheet. I've been leaning hard into the vocal repertoire for the last few episodes, and I wanted a week that belonged to the people I stand next to on a bandstand. That's horn players, not as many singers. I landed on four because I already knew the melody. I've played it, well, not well, but I've played it. I think I could tell you that it was Miles Davis, and I knew if it was on maybe Working, Steaming, Cooking, but I couldn't tell you which one. But in the journey to put the show back together this week, I ended up back with the singer.
I'm Joanna Lean, and you're listening to The Standard Show on Big E Radio from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. The Standard Show is a weekly broadcast where I take one tune from the real book and I tell you who built it, who rebuilt it, why it lasts, and who's still playing it for 1 hour, one song, week by week. So let's get into it. Miles Davis 4.
Played in E-flat. First put on tape in the spring of 1954, it's been a jam session staple and a young horn player's proving ground ever since, mostly because of what one rhythm section did to its tempo. It sits in the real book the way most durable tunes do, without much fuss, one composer's name on the credit line, and a set of changes that reward a soloist who actually listens to where they resolve. It's not really a flashy tune on paper. It's a working tune, the kind that shows up on a set list, not because anyone's making a statement by calling it, but because everybody in the room really knows it well enough to build something on top of it. By the end of the hour, you'll know why a blues shouter out of Houston might have a better claim to this tune than the man whose name on it. Why the version most horn players play isn't that 1954 original at all. And how a tune that resisted having words for most of its life ended up 70 years later in the mouth of a singer who treats his voice like a horn anyway. You're hearing the Miles Davis Quintet with Four live at Philharmonic Hall. That's February 12, 1964. You are hearing the 1954 version of Four from the Miles Davis Quartet from Prestige Blues. Miles Davis, the hood, was born on May 26, 1926 in Alton, Illinois. A family with money, which is not the ordinary story for a black family in that place and at that time. His father, also Miles II, was a dentist and a landowner who ran a 200-acre spread with horses and hogs on it, the kind of man the neighborhood called a raceman, proud, upright, and deliberate. His mother, Cleota, was classically trained. She played piano and violin and wanted her son to do the same. Family legend has it that Miles' father bought him a trumpet instead, partly to annoy his mother because she couldn't stand the sound of one. Miles was 13. By his teens, he was already sitting in on bridge across the river in East St. Louis, where the family lived when he was a toddler, taking lessons from a local musician called a Woody Cannon, and observing whatever he could from the toy players he came through, including a young St. Louis trumpeter called Bud. In the summer of 1944, Eckstein's band passed through town, and Miles filled the chair in the trumpet section for a couple of weeks. Eckstein's band carried Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, the two men already redrawing the map of music. Miles followed them east that fall, enrolled at Juilliard, mostly as a cover for his father,
and then spent his nights chasing Bird through Harlem's after-hour rooms instead, sitting in whenever he could at Minton's and Monroe's alongside Thelonious Monk, Fats Navarro, and Kenny Clarke. He dropped out of Juilliard with his father's blessing, and by 1945, he was in Parker's working quintet, 19 years old and already recording beside the two men rewriting the music from the ground up. Charlie Parker Quintet with a tune called Out of Nowhere, with a 19-year-old Miles Davis sitting in the chair. The next decade would be a busy and difficult one for Miles. The birth of Cool Sections, cut with arranger Gil Evans across 1949 and 50, was not released as a full album until 1957, pointed in one direction, towards a spacious orchestrated sound built for nine horns instead of a screaming bebop frontline. Heroin pointed the other direction entirely. Davis had picked up that habit by the end of the 40s, and by the 50s, it was serious enough that the narcotics arrest in Los Angeles that September made him close to unemployable, his name now attached to the drug bust as much as to the music. The next 3 years would be gigs he could barely make and money that went straight into his arm. Twice in 1953, he tried to get clean at his father's farm outside of Alton and failed. The third attempt, later that year, worked. He locked himself into a guest house on the property alone and wrote out the withdrawal, which he later described as feeling like every joint in his body had gone stiff and sore at once, the kind of pain you can't even touch without wanting to scream. He came out the other side of it in early 1954, telling people that he felt good and pure for the first time in years. He arrived back in New York that February, signed a fresh contract with Bob Weinstock at Prestige Records, and went to work almost immediately with a tight, road-tested quartet. That's Horace Silver on the piano, Percy Heath on bass, Art Blakey on drums, the same rhythm section he just used to close out his Blue Note contract days earlier. This is the band that cut four. It's not a tune written at leisure. In other words, it's a tune from the first weeks of a comeback, cut by a man who'd just proven to himself alone in a guest house that he could still function. the composition itself hides a small, quiet trick, one worth sitting with while this recording plays underneath. In the first 8 bars, the harmony slides from an E-flat major 7th down to an E-flat minor 7th, and the melody underlines the move by dropping the same half step from the natural 7th down to the flatted one. A few bars later, the same idea returns a step up. It moves from an A-flat major 7th toward what should be its minor twin, but right before the resolution, the tune sets up a textbook 2-5 in D-flat, the exact kind of motion every bebop trained ear expects to land squarely on D-flat major, and it doesn't. It resolves instead to F minor, a deceptive cadence hiding inside what otherwise sounds like a straightforward medium-tempo bop tune. This is the 1954 recording of 4 that's on the album titled Workin'. Whoever wrote this wanted a small element of surprise built into the form itself, not just left to the soloist's imagination. It's the kind of detail you can play past for years without noticing, and the kind that changes how a soloist chooses notes once they finally do. The tune carries Miles Davis's name on it in every pressing, every fake book, every royalty statement for 70 years. The story of how it got there isn't as straightforward. Around 1952 and 53, alto saxophonist and blues shouter Eddie Cleanhead Vinson was leading a working band out of New York City with a young John Coltrane in the saxophone section. Vinson had been in the business since about 1930. Born Edward L. Vinson Jr. in Houston in December 1917 to two parents who both played piano. Nicknamed Cleanhead, after a lye-based hair straightener burned off every strand off of his scalp as a young man. He cut his teeth touring Texas with Chester Booten's band as a teenager, moved through Milt Larkin's Houston Orchestra alongside two other future giants of the saxophone, that's Arnett Cobb and Illinois Jacquet. And by the 1940s, he was fronting Cootie Williams' big band as a featured blues singer, the voice behind hits like Cherry Red. He struck out on his own in 1945, built a 16-piece band, and scored his own hits, Kidney Stew Blues and Old Maid Boogie amongst them in 1947. By every account from musicians who played beside him, Vinson was a serious, sophisticated harmonic thinker who simply happened to make his public reputation as a shouter, and Coltrane himself later credited time in Vinson's band as formative to his own sound. A number of musicians who were around at the time, and at least one of Davis's more careful biographers, Jack Chambers, whose two-volume study, Milestones, remains one of the standard Davis biographies, hold that both 4 and this tune's close cousin, Tune Up, actually came out of Vinson's book out in this period, and that Davis acquired them from him, whether bought outright or simply taken, and put his own name on the copyright. According to Chambers, both tunes were credited to Davis for decades before anyone objected publicly enough for this story to surface. It's worth noting that the 1956 prestige album Workin' with the Miles Davis Quintet actually prints the composer credit for 4 as Vinson's, not Davis's, right there on the sleeve, a detail that sat in plain sight for years before anybody made much of it. Even the official Miles Davis estate now lists Vinson as the tune's more likely author. Whether Vinson wrote it outright, sketched it and let Davis finish it, or simply never got asked, is not a question this hour can settle. What's certain is that a tune this durable doesn't have just one clean origin story. It has a credit line and a room full of musicians who knew otherwise and mostly kept it to themselves. There is a detail worth noting because it complicates the story rather than resolving it. This is not the only time in Davis's career that a tune credited to him has drawn a serious competing claim. We've talked about Donna Lee, recorded under Charlie Parker's name and generally attributed to Parker, and was claimed by Miles Davis himself over the years. Solar, Blue and Green, and Dig all have similar disputes involving guitarist Chuck Wayne, pianist Bill Evans, and saxophonist Jackie McLean, respectively. Davis's estate publicly acknowledged Evans as the actual composer of Blue and Green only in 2002, decades after the fact. None of that proves anything specific about Four. It does suggest a pattern worth noticing. A band leader with a genuine gift for recognizing a strong tune when a sideman played him one, and considerably less interest in making sure that credit followed the idea. Four never had its own lyric written to the melody. What it got instead, 5 years after the original recording, was a lyric written to Miles Davis's trumpet solo, which is a stranger and more specific thing than it might sound.
The wonderful things that you get out of life, there are four. Baby, and there may not be many, but nobody needs any more.
Of the many facts making the list of life, truth takes the lead. And to relax, knowing the gist of life, it's truth you need.
And the second is honor, and happiness makes number three. When you put them together, you know what the last one must be.
John Hendricks, born September 16, 1921, had already built a reputation for exactly this trick. He takes an improvised instrumental line off a record note by note and sets words to it, a technique called vocalese. He'd broken through writing a lyric hit to Four Brothers with Dave Lambert before either of them had turned it into a career, and Dizzy Gillespie later dubbed him as the poet laureate of jazz for the sheer volume of solos he set to words over the decades. Basie's book, Hobeam, Charlie Parker, Horace Silver, and eventually Miles. Working with Lambert and singer Annie Ross as Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross, he transcribes Davis's own 54 solo on Four, note for note, and built a lyric around a simple conceit. He transcribed Davis's own 54 solo on Four, note for note, and built a lyric around a simple conceit, the handful of things a life actually needs, counted out to land on the number in the title, truth, honor, happiness, and one more thing besides. The trio cut it for their album The Swingers, released on World Pacific in November of 1959, part of a run of records where the whole point was singing what a horn had already played, exactly as it was played. Nothing smoothed out or simplified for the voice.
That's all, four is the figure, that's all. Ain't gonna be getting any bigger. Doesn't matter how you slice it up, you'll never change it. You count everything that fate throws into life's pot. Still, really four is all you got. Haven't I told you about the little pleasures that are part of all the rest? You love a little and live a little and take a little and give a lot. Still the total is happiness. But that's only one. You've just begun. There's gonna be more. After this, the truth and honor shining and love combining to make it four.
It borrows a trumpet player's improvisation note for note and puts a set of words in its mouth without ever asking the horn player's permission, which by most accounts caused some real friction between Hendricks and Davis afterwards, since Davis hadn't written a word of it and hadn't necessarily wanted his playing turned into a lyric sheet. It's a strange kind of authorship question to land on twice in 1 hour, a soloist's own improvised ideas ending up credited or sung or claimed by someone standing just slightly to the side of where the actual playing happened. Even the tune's one enduring set of words, in other words, is secretly an instrumental solo wearing a costume. This is about as close as Four ever got to being a singer's tune, and it got there by refusing structurally to actually be one. The melody itself still has no lyric at all, 70 years on.
The
1954 recording is dated quite precisely at March 15th, Beltone Studios in New York City. That's Miles Davis on trumpet, Horace Silver on the piano, Percy Heath on bass, Art Blakey on drums, producers Bob Weinstock and Ira Gittler. It's the same quartet that had cut a Blue Note session together just days earlier, fulfilling old contractual obligation before Davis's Prestige deal properly began, which tells you how tight this specific unit already was in that narrow window and how little time there was between Davis walking out of withdrawal and Davis walking into the recording studio. Four first surfaced on a 10-inch LP simply titled Miles Davis Quartet, Prestige Prep 1360, alongside Blue Haze and a reading of the standard Old Devil Moon from the same date. It was folded 2 years later into the 12-inch reissue Blue Haze. It made no chart noise. Nothing on Prestige Hard Bop date in 1954 was built to make chart noise. What it did instead was enter the working repertoire almost immediately, the way a genuinely useful set of changes tends to. Stan Getz cut it within a year on 1955 West Coast Jazz, then on May 11th, 56 at Rudy Van Gelder's studio in Hackensack, Davis's so-called first great quartet, John Coltrane on tenor, Red Garland on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, Philly Joe Jones on drums, cut it again for what eventually became the album Workin' with the Miles Davis Quintet, part of a marathon two-session run that also produced three more full LPs to satisfy Davis's remaining Prestige contract before his move to Columbia. Workin' wasn't released until 1960. That's the pressing that credits Vincent. By the early 60s, the tune wasn't a curiosity anymore. It was a tool horn players reached for at gigs, something with enough harmonic interest to be worth calling and enough familiarity that a rhythm session could follow without a rehearsal. And it was about to get considerably faster. You are listening to The Standard Show on Big E Radio from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and I'm your host, Giovanna Aline. You can catch The Standard Show anytime at the-standard-show.com, where you'll see the current episode as well as our archives, plus extra play with lists for iTunes and YouTube that have additional versions that I didn't have time to fit into the show weekly. February 12, 1964, Philharmonic Hall at the Lincoln Center, New York, a benefit concert for the NAACP, the Congress of Racial Equality, and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, 2 days before Valentine's Day. Miles Davis brought a quintet that was barely a year old as a working unit and already sounded like nothing else had ever in jazz. Davis is on the trumpet, George Coleman on the tenor saxophone, 23-year-old Herbie Hancock on the piano, 26-year-old Ron Carter on the bass, and 18-year-old Tony Williams on the drums. It was Davis's second time headlining a major New York hall for a taped benefit. He'd done Carnegie Hall in 1961 and initially resisted the idea of recording it. This time, 3 years on, everything was in place. The concert taped cleanly, the band road tested, and just short of its first anniversary as a unit, still finding out in real time what it could do with the familiar tune. Columbia got so much usable material out of that single concert that they split it across two albums by mood, an unusual choice at the time. The ballads became My Funny Valentine, delicate and unhurried, with Williams occasionally dropping out entirely to just let the tune breathe. The up-tempo material, including Four, became Four and More, released January 17, 1966, 2 years after the fact, once Columbia had decided how to sequence and market two records out of one night's work. What happens on this recording is simple to describe and hard to overstate. Williams just keeps pushing the time forward through the set, and Davis, rather than reining him in, just lets him. A tune that had been a relaxed, medium-tempo blowing vehicle in 54 becomes something closer to a controlled sprint. The melody thrown out fast, solos launched with almost no runway. The whole band is operating at a tempo that leaves no room to think your way through a phrase. You can just react to it. Davis said afterward that Coleman played better that night than he had ever heard him play. That's high praise from a band leader not known for handing it out freely. Herbie Hancock's intros on this record become almost as recognizable as the melodies themselves, and Ron Carter's time, steady, steady underneath all of it, is a big part of why this band could push so hard without falling apart. Columbia's decision to split the concert by mood rather than by song means that Four arrives on Four and More without much ceremony. One up-tempo burner among several alongside Walkin', Joshua, Seven Steps to Heaven, and a rare outing on the standard There Is No Greater Love, the only tune on the record not taken at the same breakneck pace. That's arguably the point. This wasn't a special performance built around one tune. It was a working band playing its book at the edge of what the book could stand, and Four happens to be on the set list that night, same as it would have been any other night that the quartet had played that winter. What makes this reading different from the 54 quartet isn't just speed for speed's sake. At this tempo, the tune's internal surprises, that deceptive resolution into the F minor we set back in the first act, arrive and pass almost before you can register them, which changes what the soloist actually does. There's no time to plan a phrase around the trick anymore. You either hear it coming in real time and use it, or you just throw it out. Coleman, Hancock, and Davis all find different answers to that problem across their solos, and none of them sound rattled by it, which is a big part of why the recording became the reference point it did. Whoever actually wrote the tune, this is the night Miles Davis rebuilt it to in public, in front of the audience gathered for a civil rights benefit. And this tempo, not the relaxed 54 original, is what horn players are actually chasing when you call the tune at a session today. Blues, Bob, and a little Calypso. That is Sonny Rollins making you wait for it with that long unaccompanied cadenza. And he quotes so many other songs, and he makes you wait for the actual melody to arrive. By the time the band comes in on the real tune, it feels earned rather than announced. That's Sonny Rollins on tenor saxophone, Kenny Drew on the piano, N.H.O.P. on the bass, Albert Tutti Heath on the drums, live in Copenhagen in 1968. Rollins by 68 had spent most of the decade taking these long, wandering, self-imposed introductions on standards, treating the audience's expectations of the melody as something to play with rather than something to just deliver on cue. This particular introduction touches on fragments of other tunes entirely before ever settling anywhere near Four. a habit of Rollins that some critics have called quotation for its own sake, and others have called it one of the most genuinely conversational things a soloist can do. A way of telling the room everything that he's thinking about and everything that's within him before he commits to the thing that he's actually come to play. Drew, Peterson, and Heath just wait it out, waiting for the signal, and when it arrives, they snap into the tune at a full tempo, like a door swinging open. It's a very different kind of rebuilding than what Miles did with the tempo 4 years earlier. Rollins doesn't speed the tune up so much as making you sit inside the anticipation of it, stretching the distance between the audience wanting the melody and actually getting it.
Thank you.
Oh, now the avant-garde. Here's Cecil Taylor on piano, Jimmy Lyons alto saxophone, Albert Eiler tenor sax, Sonny Murray on drums. It's recorded at the Café Montmartre, Copenhagen, possibly November 16 of 1962. It was unreleased for 42 years until it surfaced on Revenant Records' 9-disc Albert Eiler box set, Holy Ghost, in 2004. This take runs almost 22 minutes, more than the 5 times the length of the original, and the quartet treats Ford's head as a door they kind of sprint through and they just never walk back into that room. Some context on how it even reached us. Eiler was 26, largely unknown outside a small circle in Scandinavia, sitting in with Cecil Taylor's group during a European stretch that also produced recordings in Helsinki. And this particular Copenhagen set was in the vault for over 4 decades before Revenant's box finally surfaced in 2004, meaning it's technically older than the 4 and More record I played earlier in the hour, but has been publicly available for barely a fifth as long. Sonny Murray isn't keeping time in the conventional sense here. He's generating kind of a weather movement around the other three. And Taylor's piano and Eiler's tenor spend most of the piece well outside anything you'd call the tune's harmony. Jimmy Lyons on alto is the closest thing to a bebop anchor left in the group, and even he spends most of the 22 minutes pulling away from the melody rather than moving towards it. I don't know what to tell you to listen for in this one. And I'm not sure there's a wrong answer to whether it's still the same tune by the time they finished it. What do you hear in it? 20 minutes in. You can always go to the-standard-show to hear the full versions of the tunes with the full lineups. And I'm always glad to hear from you. My email address is host@the-standard-show.com. Thank you. four landed in the real book the way most durable working tunes did, because it was already on stands at gigs and in rehearsal rooms before anybody compiling a fake book thought to check who actually wrote it. The original underground volumes, assembled by Boston area musicians and students in the 70s, wrote down the name printed on the record label. This time it's Davis's, and it has carried through six editions since, regardless of what the 1956 prestige sleeve says. The current legal edition carries the chart in volume one in the key of E-flat, a 32-bar A-B-A-C form. The wildly cited criteria list for the sixth edition flags one specific correction. Measure 11 should carry a written B-flat, not a natural B, a small but audible fix once you know how to listen for it. The chart also doesn't warn you about the tune's own trick, the deceptive resolution into F minor, where your ear expects D-flat major in bar 6 and 7, the same move we sat with under the music bed in Act 1. If you're calling this at a jam with a piano player who's reading it cold, say something before the first chorus, or you'll get a very confused comp on the second time through and possibly a dirty look. Garland cut his own version of Four as a trio plus guitar date on May 24th of 1957 at Van Gelder's studio in Hackensack. That's Red Garland on the piano, Kenny Burrell on the guitar, Paul Chambers bass, Art Taylor drums. It would sit in the vault for over a decade because Prestige didn't release it until 1969 on the compilation called Red Garland Revisited, with an exclamation. Burrell only appears on two of the album's eight tracks, Four and Walkin', so his presence there is clearly a deliberate pairing, not just part of the regular working band. It's a really nice companion piece to the tune that you already heard earlier in this episode. It's the same pianist roughly a year later from the Coltrane recording, but now leading his own band instead of comping for Miles Davis and Train. It runs 5 minutes 17 seconds instead of the tighter quintet reading. Burrell's guitar tempers it without losing the blues feel, but really pushing it into that bebop language. I think it's a version worth hearing. Thank you. So Four starts with a blues shout out of a Houston with a horn in his hands and no name to the copyright, a tune he may have built and then watched get carried off under someone else's signature, decades passing before anyone said out loud. And a trumpet player coming out of a guest house in Illinois in the winter of 1954, cold turkey, needing new material and needing it fast, putting his name to it in either way and never looking back. At a singer setting words to the same trumpet player's own improvised solo instead of the melody, borrowing his voice without asking and causing the exact kind of friction you'd expect. At a saxophone 4 years from becoming a band leader himself, already pulling against the changes that he'd been handed, testing what else lived inside a deceptive cadence nobody else had time to notice. At another saxophone, making you wait a full unaccompanied minute for a melody he'll eventually get to, and he might give it to you. He treats your patience like it's part of the arrangement. At a pianist and a drummer, a second saxophonist walking through the tune's front door once in Copenhagen and simply never turning back. 22 minutes and gone, sitting unheard in a vault for 42 years before anyone got to hear what they'd done. And an 18-year-old drummer at Philharmonic Hall who kept nudging the tempo forward until a relaxed bop tune turned into a dare, and a trumpet player who'd let him do it all the way to the recording every horn player still measures themselves against 6 decades later. And then here's a singer 60 years after that concert who takes the same tune, the same borrowed lyric, and treats his throat like a fifth horn in the band, closing a loop that started with a man whose name never even made it onto the page. Michael Mayo recorded Four on Mack Avenue Records on October 4th of 1924, with a big band version added to the deluxe edition in September of 2025. Mayo grew up classically trained in Los Angeles, has toured with everyone from Herbie Hancock to Jacob Collier, and built his sophomore album, Fly, around the idea that respecting the tradition doesn't mean copying it. He's talked about wanting his musical statements to feel natural rather than deliberately modern, which may be why Four doesn't sound like some sort of stunt. Mayo still sings John Hendrick's 1959 lyric, the same words written to Davis's own solo, but he sets it inside a funk rebuild of the tune at roughly 175 beats per minute and delivers his one chorus improvisations less like a vocalist working a lyric and more like a horn player working changes, locking into the groove with the same rhythmic precision the tune has demanded from saxophones and trumpets for 75 years. Four earned Mayo a nomination for Best Jazz Performance at the 68th Grammy Awards held earlier this year. Fly itself was nominated for Best Jazz Vocal Album. Linda May Han Oh follows Michael's vocal chorus with a full bass solo of her own, melodically inventive, holding the funk groove while still reaching for the tune's older harmonic sophistication underneath it. It's a strange kind of closing the loop. The tune's only real lyric was always a trumpet solo in disguise, and 70 years later, the freshest recording is of a singer who treats his own voice exactly like the horn players before him treated theirs, which means even the vocal version in the end is an instrumentalist's tune.
Of the wonderful things that you get in a life, there are four. Now there may not be many, but nobody needs any more. Of the many facts making the list of life, truth takes the lead. And to relax, knowing the gist of life, is truth you need. Then the second is honor, and happiness makes number three. When you put them together, you know what the last one must be. Baby, so the truth, honor and happiness, and one thing more, meaning only wonderful, wonderful love that'll make it four. La ba 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 Facts making the list of life. Truth takes the lead, and to relax, knowing the gist of life is truth you need. And the second is honor, and happiness makes number three. When you put them together, you know what the last one must be. Baby, so the truth, honor, and happiness, and one thing more, meaning only wonderful, wonderful love that'll make it fall. Better make it fall. Make it fall.
You've been listening to The Standard Show on Big E Radio from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. You'll find extended versions and this week's listening list at the-standard-show.com. I'm Joanna Lean. Keep listening, keep loving, keep playing. Good night.
Hey there, music lovers. Did you know that getting licensed to share music online is not just the right thing to do? It's also super important for supporting creators and the music industry. That's why we're proud to be licensed by SOCAN, a copyright collective that grants licenses for online music broadcasts in Canada. By getting licensed through SOCAN, you ensure that every beat, every note, and every melody that you play is compliant and fair to the creators. Join us in supporting the music community. Visit SOCAN's website at www.socan.com and get your web radio, podcast, or any other use of online music licensed today. Let's stream beautiful music together, legally and ethically. SOCAN, music, people, connected.